I'm Rachel Louise Snyder with the World Vision Report. On this week's program, troubleshooting in paradise. In the Himalayan country of Bhutan, the queen is trekking from town to town to speak out against domestic violence.
Being a Buddhist country and being Buddhist, we believe in being compassionate.
Cuba tiptoes toward the free market. Thousands of Cubans are buying licenses to start their own businesses.
My name is Salvador Valle Bagbo, tire repairman, numbered 74.
Emilio Noel Benitez Matamoro, profession photographer, number 50 on the list.
And Songs of Migration, a musical in South Africa, honors the immigrants who labored in the country's gold mines. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. While all eyes have been on North Africa and the Middle East these last few months, some significant changes in Cuba have gone more or less unnoticed. The communist government there announced a major shift in policy, allowing private citizens to open their own small businesses for the very first time. Thousands of Cubans have embraced the idea, trading their government jobs for self-employment. But the introduction of free enterprise into this staunchly socialist country has been rocky. Many people are struggling to adapt. Our Latin America correspondent, Grant Fuller, has the story from Havana.
A young Cuban named Luis rides a bicycle taxi. The gears churn beneath him as he pedals hard through old Havana. Luis knows these bumpy streets like the back of his hand. But in another sense, he's venturing down an unpaved path. Luis belongs to Cuba's new army of the self-employed. He recently ditched his old state-run construction job in favor of the freedom of private enterprise.
They put me on leave for a while to wait for another contract, but it was taking a long time, and since I've got kids, I had to get out and find a different job to live on.
Now, he's part of Socialist Cuba's cautious experiment with free market capitalism. Luis rents the bike taxi from its owner for a few pennies. In just 2 days, he can earn up to $15. That's almost as much as the average state worker makes in a whole month. But there is a trade-off. 40% of his modest income goes toward annual taxes. He also has to cough up Social Security taxes every 3 months, and a monthly license fee of $10.
I'm still working for the state. Every one of us is. There's not a single person here who doesn't work for the state.
Despite the steep taxes, thousands of Cubans are trying their hand at private enterprise. The government published a list of 178 officially sanctioned jobs, including makeup artists, photographers, plumbers, translators, and gardeners. Walk the streets of Havana and you can't miss them, with their brand new laminated licenses proudly clipped to their shirts.
My name is Luis. I have a bicycle taxi, number 175 on the list.
My name is Salvador Valle Bagbo, tire repairman, number 74.
Emilio Noel Benitez Matamoro, profession photographer, number 50 on the list.
I'm number 98,
vendor of decorative flowers and plants.
My name is Ruben Paul Jimenez, number 142, produce vendor.
38-year-old Ruben Paul Jimenez sells fruit and potatoes out of a warehouse in Guanabo, just outside Havana. He can't land a government job because he served 8 years in prison for armed robbery.
If you've got a record, they'll only pay you $5 a month. And that's not even enough to catch the bus.
So when the self-employment licenses became available, it was an easy choice. Ruben says he actually learned business skills by smuggling goods into prison. But now, his produce stand is completely legal, and the risk is minimal.
It's beneficial because the government takes care of your business. If it were an underground thing, everything would go downhill. They'll take your business from you and throw you out in the street. The government is not good, but it's good to do business with the government.
Ruben says he finally feels like a respectable person again, rather than a criminal. He always has a dollar in his wallet, ready to give to his preteen daughter when she needs it.
That makes me feel happy about my life. Because when I was a kid, they were never able to do that for me. Not because they didn't want to, but because they just couldn't afford it. So I want to give her what they never gave me.
More than 170,000 Cubans now have these work permits. That's ahead of pace to meet the government's goal of 250,000 by the end of the year. But the rush to the private sector also means competition is fierce. Informal snack bars have sprung up on nearly every Havana block. One woman who sells coffee and baked goods out of her living room window was too scared to be interviewed on tape, but she was willing to write down answers to my questions. She told me that when the reform was announced, she faced a tough decision: pay for the privilege of having an official business, or stay in the black market where she'd make more money. This is what she wrote.
It would be better that way, but when so many people have legal licenses, there's always someone who will tell on you and kill your business. Nothing has changed here. On the contrary, it's tougher than before. A lot of work for a little money.
Along Havana's famous Malecón, the seaside promenade, two old men with guitars play Cuban classics for tips. Right behind them, fellow entrepreneurs stroll the sidewalk, selling peanuts, candy bars, flowers, and ice cream. These simple acts of daily commerce would have been nearly impossible before the reform. But now they're all legal, and the vendors represent the vanguard of change in Cuba. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Havana.
During the revolution in Egypt, Muslims and Christians united to oust the government. During those tense days in Tahrir Square, Christians and Muslims famously protected each other during prayers. Many believed it was the beginning of a new Egypt, one in which the Coptic Christians wouldn't feel marginalized by the Muslim majority. But since then, a crack has formed in their united front. Several clashes with religious overtones have proven deadly. As Bonnie Allen reports, old differences still plague post-revolution Egypt.
In the Cairo slum of Manshiat Nasser, a middle-aged Christian woman searches for glass bottles in a pile of rotting food and cardboard that spills out the front door of her house. She's called the Mother of Ayman, after her eldest son. She says Christians and Muslims have lived and worked together peacefully here for years, collecting, sorting, and recycling rubbish on the streets. But that suddenly changed after Egypt's revolution, when a small protest turned ugly and, she says, young Muslim men attacked her neighborhood.
We were sitting in our houses and we did nothing, yet they raided us and they beat us, destroyed cars, and they burned our houses out there.
A clash actually started when young Christian men blocked a major road in the neighborhood to protest the burning of a church elsewhere in Egypt. Angry over the road closure, truck drivers and Muslim youth began to hurl stones at them. According to media reports, tensions escalated when soldiers loyal to the former Mubarak regime intervened and began to shoot into the crowd. Reports differ, but in the end, 13 people were killed and dozens were injured on both sides. And the once harmonious community of Manshiat Nasser became divided along religious lines. The mother of Ayman now keeps her children home from school because she's afraid Muslim men will kidnap her daughters, even though there's no evidence to suggest anything like that has ever happened. Around the corner, Yusuf Shaleh uses a sewing machine to assemble shoes from recycled rubber. He says some of his best friends are Muslims, and yet...
Now the dissension has spread all over the country. So you can imagine that any young man can harm or beat up any girl passing by. Yes, this is a possibility.
The Coptic Christians make up about 10% of Egypt's 82 million people, the largest Christian population in the Middle East. Generally, Christians and Muslims have coexisted in peace here, but there are underlying tensions. Egypt's constitution declares that Islam is the religion of the state and that Islamic Sharia law is the main source of legislation. Christians complain that they've been excluded from positions of authority and jobs. And when private conflicts emerge, such as land disputes between farmers or arguments among shopkeepers, they can quickly deteriorate into religious name-calling and violence. On the streets of Cairo, near Tahrir Square, Egyptians gather to debate their political future. A man named Ali dismisses Christian concerns that conservative Islamic groups like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafis could take power and persecute them. It's fear-mongering, he tells me. Ali blames the recent violence on the former Mubarak regime.
We have nothing between Muslim and Christian. Who's the doing the problem between Muslim and the Christian? The police. Why? To make a problem between the people.
But in the town of Soule, 60 miles south of Cairo, I find the blackened concrete rubble of that church that was burned. Military officers use heavy machinery to scoop up debris. It's difficult to find anyone who will speak about what happened. Then I meet Taha Ali, a Muslim school teacher. He tells me that an angry mob of young Muslim men torched the church after discovering that a Muslim girl and Christian boy were having a forbidden romance. Ali is ashamed of what happened in his community, but he did what he could to help.
We stood in front of the church to defend it, but we could not control the anger of the youth. As for their Christian properties, we protected them, and some families spent the night in our houses. And there was no problem at all.
Around the corner, down a dusty trail, the town council gathers at noon to discuss the church's reconstruction. Eight Muslim men and two Christians sit in a row, shoulder to shoulder. They all insist the church burning was an isolated incident. A family dispute, they say, and not a religious conflict. For many, many generations, we've been living together, says one of the Christian counselors. Our interests, lands, and houses are together, and we live, sell, and buy together. We coexist. There are no differences or problems. But back in the garbage-filled slums of Manshiat Nasser, the mother of Ayman is too afraid to leave her house.
Even now, we are living in terror. We cannot go out. Believe me, we are tired. We cannot sleep at night. But God is there with us. We can do nothing but pray to God.
She prays for security, as well as a new government that will protect religious minorities. An election is scheduled for the fall. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Cairo, Egypt.
I'm Bashir Soussial in Kabul, Afghanistan. You're listening to the World Vision Report.
And coming up next, we go to India to look at a microloan meltdown that's happening as we speak.
And at the end of the day, who is the loser? It's the borrower. We are taking the state back to 20 years. Industry will not exist for more than 4 months from now.
I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Microlending has been hailed as the silver bullet to help end poverty. But the practice of lending small amounts of money to the world's poor hasn't been a particularly attractive business proposition for traditional banks. The amounts are too small and the risks are too high. The gap's been filled by nonprofits who've led the way in microfinance in the developing world. In India, though, private lenders have entered the market, hoping to expand the practice to more people, and of course, to make a profit. But a lack of regulation and sketchy lending practices have left the entire system facing collapse. Elliot Hannon reports from the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh.
This is what microfinance was meant to look like. In the village of Nizamabad, 20 women wrapped in brightly colored saris sit cross-legged in the shade. The women trade stories about family and neighbors, but while their monthly gathering is a social affair, it is also a business meeting. These women are all members of a small credit union that offers microlending. They've all taken out loans of anywhere from $100 to $500. Some of that money comes from the funds the women have contributed themselves, and some comes from outside bank loans. Each loan must be approved by the other members, and everyone is responsible for the other members' debts. Every month, they assemble to settle accounts. Vray Lakshmi opens a neatly wrapped plastic bag with meticulously kept notebooks inside. 2 years ago, Lakshmi took out a loan of about $450 to open a general store. Each month, she repays $25. Lakshmi says the small loan has transformed her life. I was a housewife, and I used the money to open a small store. Business is good, and I have confidence I will pay it off, she says. The store sits about a block away down a dirt road. It's the size of a small bedroom. A young boy comes in to buy nuts and grains for his family's evening meal. Lakshmi's sister-in-law, Rama Davi, wraps the packets in newspaper. The store's profits are small, usually amounting to less than $10 a day. But Davi says the business has been a success.
I work every day from morning to evening, but we own the shop and it's earning well.
In the past, small profit margins made it nearly impossible for India's poor to get traditional loans. That's why microfinance has been such a success. Even small amounts of capital can help break the cycle of poverty in many small villages across India. But the success of groups like this one has also led to an influx of private for-profit lenders looking to make money on small cash loans. Trident is one for-profit group operating in Andhra Pradesh. Its managing director is Kishore Kumar Puli.
You know, when we started our operations, we have chosen areas where microfinance institutions are not completely present. Trident has been focusing on reaching the unreached people.
The idea, Puli says, was to provide a service to people without access to banks, but to do that through traditional lending practices.
So no way we were under the impression that, or we are under the impression that we are doing some charity. No.
Trident is just one of many for-profit lenders that quickly popped up across Andhra Pradesh. In some ways, the for-profit lenders weren't that much different from the nonprofits. But nonprofit groups like the Women's Credit Union are slower and more careful in making their loans. That's partly because it's their own money that is part of the loan pool. For-profit lenders, however, are driven by the bottom line, so they're quicker to disperse money with fewer restrictions. And they operate like many banks. They're anonymous, faraway institutions that are less forgiving in terms of repayment. Still, the kind of easy cash they provide is often too much to resist. On a busy side street in Nizamabad, Sheikh Nazreen sits on a carpet covering her living room's cement floor. She took out one loan from a nonprofit to start a small tailoring shop. But it wasn't enough, so she took out a second loan from a for-profit. There were consequences.
We're happy to have the money, and for some weeks we are repaying. But after that, we feel so much pressure. With these loans, there's 10% benefit, 90% loss. The loss is the pressure and mental agony.
Nazreen isn't alone. Many poor borrowers like her have been unable to repay the high interest rates on their loans. Some even take out two or three to pay back the first one and only dig themselves deeper. Late last year, dozens of borrowers committed suicide in Andhra Pradesh. The deaths made national news in India. That's when the state government stepped in and put an indefinite hold on all debt repayments for borrowers. Parliament member Syed Aziz Pasha says that was a good thing.
No responsible government or no responsible political party will say you need not repay the loans. We are not against private finance, but private finance is indulged into exploitation of the poor rather than helping them, because their motto is business.
But at Trident, the for-profit lender, Kumar Puli, warns that the government's actions will ultimately hurt the poor. He says collection rates have fallen from 99% to 5% since the moratorium on repayments went into effect, and it's going to destroy lenders.
And at the end of the day, who is the loser? It's the borrower. We are taking the state back to 20 years. Industry will not exist for more than 4 months from now.
As the women in the nonprofit credit union finish up the day's work in song, they have concerns of their own. Several of them are having trouble paying off multiple loans from for-profit sources. One member has recently been diagnosed with cancer and hasn't been able to pay in the last 9 months due to medical bills. But instead of harassing her, the women have picked up her tab. They're hoping that when times get tough for them, others will do the same. For the World Vision Report, I'm Elliot Hannon in Hyderabad, India.
Many of New Orleans residents lost everything in Hurricane Katrina, and those losses often linger in surprising places. Some residents recall clotheslines sagging with soaked recipe cards, neighbors praying the cards would dry. For a food-loving town where treasured recipes are handed down for generations, that culinary loss endures. And while many recipes and cookbooks couldn't be saved, Mary Stuckey reports that not all gastronomic hope is lost.
Shannon Jones is in the kitchen chopping celery for the chicken and sausage gumbo that's bubbling on her stove.
What we're doing is we're starting to saute the vegetables, the trinity. What we call the trinity is celery, bell peppers, and onions.
Jones loves her new house, rebuilt on exactly the same spot as her old house, which was destroyed when the levees broke. When the floodwaters receded, she tried to rescue her recipes. But all was lost.
It was the first thing I thought about was my cookbooks. My own personal notes. I took notes while I was being taught to cook this gumbo. It took me years to remember that I was supposed to be putting liquid smoke in it.
Losing their recipes was one big part of the disaster. Here, food is life.
We go out to lunch and sit around in restaurants at lunchtime discussing where we're going to go out to dinner. When my son and I go on vacation, he always says, "That was fun when we're getting on the plane to come home. Now let's go home and eat."
That's New Orleans, says Judy Walker, food editor at the Times-Picayune newspaper. Almost immediately after Katrina, Walker began getting requests for recipes destroyed in the flood. When she couldn't find a recipe herself, she put a notice in the newspaper.
I had two people ask me for the exact same recipe on the same day for that sweet potato corn and jalapeno bisque. You know, things kept happening like that.
So while the city was being rebuilt, Walker engaged in her own reconstruction project. She began collecting recipes unique to this melting pot of Creole, Cajun, Italian, African, French, and German cuisine. The cookbook she eventually co-authored, called Cooking Up a Storm, was published 2 years ago.
I realized that this project wouldn't have been needed had this horrible disaster happened elsewhere. But in New Orleans, because we specifically have this culture of food, because we have these specific ingredients, we needed our recipes back. You know, The Joy of Cooking is a wonderful cookbook. Doesn't have a lot of crawfish recipes in it.
In Walker's cookbook, there's crawfish and corn chowder, crawfish in saffron sauce, crawfish pie, even Jerry's crawfish bread.
We have always had a huge number of desserts and sweets based on cane sugar. Of course, we have the famous pralines. They're very sweet. They're very good. I cannot resist them.
And you say praline, not praline.
Oh, no, not praline. It's a praline here. And it's crawfish, not crayfish.
And it's roux, a mix of fat and flour, an important ingredient in gumbo. Shannon Jones toasts her roux to a deep chocolate color, stirring for nearly an hour. Gumbo is one of the first things Jones made after Katrina. It was a source of comfort to her and the friends who sheltered her after the storm.
So many of us needed a place to just kind of gather. People were either living in tiny apartments or commuting from Baton Rouge or living in trailers. And we had these dinner parties every single Wednesday.
Now, more than 5 years later, they're still gathering every week to cook and eat together in each other's homes. Finally, it's my turn to sit down with a big bowl of Shannon's chicken and andouille sausage gumbo.
Mmm. Oh, that sticks to your ribs.
Mmm.
Mmm. Oh, smooth, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's that velvetiness that comes from the roux. This gumbo is a classic. Classic. You just keep making it till you figure out what you're forgetting each time.
But if she can't remember,
Shannon Jones can find 6 different recipes for gumbo in Cooking Up a Storm, dedicated to citizens of the Gulf Coast. The hurricane and floodwaters may have destroyed their homes and leveled their communities, but these Louisianans are determined to make sure it didn't wipe out their culture. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in New Orleans.
Well, it might not come from one of those handed-down recipes, but ready-to-use food has its place. In fact, it's been one of the great advancements in treating malnourished children in recent years. These ready nutrition packs contain highly fortified, dense pastes that children can eat straight from the package. They don't require cooking or refrigeration. The packs have allowed children to recover from acute starvation without being hospitalized. The problem is, they aren't widely available. Yet.
There's not enough government money. There's not enough foundation money.
This is Lauren Walters. He and his partner, Will Hauser, have started a company, 2Degrees, whose aim is to provide ready-to-eat nutrition packs to millions of children and make a profit while they're at it. Here's the plan.
For every bar that's sold in the United States, we purchase and then donate a nutrition pack to a severely malnourished kid.
This kind of social entrepreneurship is all the buzz in the business world these days. But 2Degrees thinks consumers will respond to its plan because it's not about giving money. It's about paying it forward, tangibly.
I think when we're talking to retailers or we're talking to just a regular consumer, they say it's such a simple idea. Buy a bar and give a bar.
Their concept is also based on their belief that there's a huge market out there of people looking for small ways to help.
And the idea of mobilizing, really as a movement, mobilizing individual consumers to change their daily purchase habits and say, I can help too. I can help that kid in Malawi or in Kenya or in Ethiopia. I can help in a direct way. We think that's a really powerful idea.
2Degrees is working with Boston-based Partners in Health to distribute the nutrition packs. The company also plans to have the packs manufactured in the same country where they're consumed. They've been testing their ideas in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world, where hundreds of thousands of children under age 5 are severely malnourished.
The ingredients are sourced in Malawi, they create local jobs, and then we purchase the product in Malawi and give them to Partners in Health in Malawi for distribution.
Of course, 2Degrees founders Lauren Walters and Will Hauser are also hoping their venture will make them a little money. They're banking on the huge popularity of energy bars. In the U.S., some $5 billion worth of these bars are sold each year. That could feed a lot of hungry children. You can find out more about the company, including where to buy the bars, at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Kenyan reporter Ernest Waitetu has experienced what it's like to be hungry. On a reporting trip to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, Ernest decided to live on a dollar a day, like thousands of other people in the country. He joined a construction worker and about 40 young people for dinner on the streets of Addis. The dinner consisted of leftovers scraped from plates in various restaurants around the town. Here is Ernest's reporter's notebook.
You would have thought after having grown up in Africa, I would know a thing or two about this kind of extreme poverty. But nothing had prepared me for what I was going to find here. In the moment, I realized there are many rungs to being poor. If you have a roof over your head and some clean food to eat, then you're certainly not poor. I will never again call myself poor. There's hierarchy here. The seniors wait. The juniors go for the food. The juniors will have to work by cleaning fancy restaurants and coffee shops in the city in exchange for food. The youth will sweep and mop the floors before taking the trash out to the dumps. When they move the trash, they'll also carry with them their daily rations gathered from different tables in the restaurants and dumped into leftover containers. Because I'm Said's guest, I will eat without working. While we wait, Said introduces me to his friends. I do not get to meet Said's wife, but Said volunteers some information about her. They met on the streets after she had quarreled with her family. Said took her in, and a few months later, we exchanged rings, Said says, pointing to the shiny golden ring on his hand, and decided to be man and wife. Said says he loves her so much. A After 10 years on the streets without family, his wife is the only hope. He arrived in Addis from northern Ethiopia after disagreeing with his family. To this date, his family does not know where he lives. "I guess they think I'm dead," he says. As these thoughts race through my mind, the food arrives. It is in two black plastic bags carried by two teenage boys. Said tears the sides of the bags and puts them flat on the ground. There are more than 10 men and women here to share. I look at the contents. They are a mixture of injera, their traditional Ethiopian bread, vegetables, meat, soup, and God knows what else. As I glance at the contents, the others in the group are having their fill. Said throws me a searching look and tells me to get eating. I dip my hand into the communal serving and get out with a piece of bread and a slice of blackened something. I start chewing on the bread. Then Said looks at what I picked and thrusts his hand into the food and adds his scoop onto mine. It is nauseating, but I have to keep eating. All the eyes of the group are on me. It would be very shameful for I, who had promised to join them for dinner, not to eat with them. So I eat. 10 long minutes and excruciating nausea later, we are done eating. Said congratulates me on job well done. I thank him for the food and hospitality. It's now 10 p.m. The ceremony is over. We decide to part ways. I leave for my house in Addis to rest and wait to see how my tummy would handle the dinner I had just taken. I retire to bed a little disturbed about why I had to intrude into these people's lives. Was it really worth it? Maybe, maybe not. It added nothing to Said's life, but I'm comforted by the belief that telling a story is usually a first step towards intervention. Maybe telling this story would compel people to do something about street kids in Addis.
Next, we introduce you to an inspiring royal. And her name's not Kate or Diana. We mean the hiking, barrier-breaking, mountaineering Queen of Bhutan. That story just ahead on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. The Kingdom of Bhutan is a tiny country with lush mountains and ancient Buddhism. It's tucked up against the Himalayas between India and China. Bhutan is known for its policy of gross national happiness, a way of kind of measuring quality of life in non-economic terms. But even here, there are serious social ills. Among them, domestic violence. This is something the Queen of Bhutan finds deplorable, and she set out to change people's behavior one strenuous step at a time. Stephanie Geyer-Stevens of Outer Voices reports.
A story about domestic violence is not a story you'd expect to hear about Bhutan, but this is the story that brought me here. In Bhutan, they might say telling this story is my destiny, my karma. My journey starts here in Thimphu.
I'm Chimi Wangmu.
I'm following a woman named Chimi Wangmo through a narrow alleyway. Chimi's the director of Renew, a group dedicated to stopping domestic violence and promoting women's rights. She's bringing me to a shelter, the first safe house in Bhutan. This is where I meet a small, elderly woman.
My name is Mumta.
Mumta's story is tragic. Speaking in Nepali, she explains that her daughter committed suicide to escape an abusive husband, and Mumtha's own husband died trying to prevent his daughter's death.
She went to commit suicide and jumped into the river in Paro, and her husband went to save her, but he also got washed away with his daughter. She lost her husband and daughter together.
Her three grandchildren are all she has left.
She's also finished her tears. I mean, how long is she going to cry? That's what she's saying. She's thankful to Renew for bringing her here. she thinks about her three little grandchildren, and that even if she dies, she's confident that the children will be well looked after by us and by Her Majesty.
Her Majesty is Queen Sange Choden Wangchuck. The Queen founded Renew. She sees it as her responsibility to help end her people's suffering. She also speaks out about a whole range of taboo issues: domestic violence, HIV, birth control. And in doing that, she makes them a part of day-to-day conversation. And to deliver her message, the Queen regularly treks into the farthest corners of the kingdom.
I think it's a nice morning air. Crisp. Not much sun.
The Queen, or Ashi as she's called, is hiking on a steep, winding trail along the banks of the Jomo River. She's accompanied by Renew's Chimiwangmo and an entourage of officials, bodyguards, and porters. We're all headed to the tiny village of Shinkalauri, 2 days' walk from the nearest road.
So now we're going to cross this nice bridge. We have to be a little careful because it sways quite a bit.
Even when she's hiking, the Queen wears kira, a colorful woven ankle-length skirt with a silk blouse and silk jacket. Looking at her, you'd never guess what an incredible trekker she is. We all struggle to keep up with her.
Everyone better take it easy. We've got a long journey ahead of us.
At the end of our second day, we get our first glimpse of Shinkalauri. The villagers gather to greet us. Some people have walked for days to get here to meet their queen. The town is decked out in flowers. Prayer flags fly from bamboo poles. Down below, on a large field, groups of school children, villagers, and monks are gathering. They dance and sing for the queen. In return, the queen feeds them all lunch and talks one-on-one with as many of them as she can. I've never witnessed anything quite like this. Ashi and Chimi address the crowd. The queen talks about unsafe sex and HIV. She tells women to get pap smears. Chimi joins in to talk about domestic violence.
When a man volunteered, he said he has never heard of domestic violence in his village here. So the woman said, yes, there's plenty. People drink, and there are also plenty of women who go through abusive relationships. So I was telling them that if they can, they should stop. But if they do not stop, it's also criminal. They have to know that. And I was also telling them that we have volunteers all over now. We know what you're doing. Sometimes it works.
Being a Buddhist country and being Buddhist, we believe in being compassionate and trying to, you know, involve everyone towards moving forward.
The Queen does involve everyone. People trust her. They believe in her. Together, the Queen and her people are changing Bhutan. Again, Chimiwangmo.
It's not the short-term happiness that we are talking about when we talk about gross national happiness. It's not the destination to arrive at, but it's the process. It's the manner in which we travel.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Stephanie Geyer-Stevens in Shinkalauri, Bhutan.
This piece was co-produced by Jack Chance for Outer Voices.
I'm Remy Tan Segovia-Anonas in Manila, Philippines, and you're listening to the World Vision Report.
Earlier in the show, you heard a report from Grant Fuller about Cubans being allowed to start businesses. While Grant was in Cuba, he got to know the intimate scaffolding that supports Fidel Castro's socialist society. Working underground as a foreign journalist, he befriended some helpful Cubans and soon experienced firsthand what it means to live in a place where simple freedoms are still a distant hope. Grant Fuller sent us this reporter's notebook from Havana.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Havana.
From the moment I landed in Cuba, I was aware they would be watching me. After 50 years of the Castro regime, no one escapes the government's eye. I was questioned and searched at the airport. Then I went for a walk through downtown Havana. That's when I stumbled upon a game of dominoes that would alter the course of my stay in Cuba. I watched the men play and snapped some photos. I asked, "Who's the champion here?" "Him," they said, pointing at a scrawny old man wearing a USA baseball cap. He taunted his rivals, saying things like, "Don't be upset, you just lost to the champion." The champ and his godson, let's call him Julio, befriended me. They even took me to a baseball game. No doubt, they saw an opportunity. Cubans are always on the lookout for a little extra cash. Hay que inventar, they say. You have to invent a way to make a living. Helping journalists is a good way to do that. Too bad it's illegal. Even walking down the street with a foreigner can bring trouble with the police. Before I knew it, the champ, Julio, and I were getting an Afro-Cuban religious blessing from a female priest. We would need all the good vibes we could get. Then we hit the road in our rental car, searching for interviews with new entrepreneurs. Getting Cubans to talk was no problem. Getting them to talk on tape was another story. People were afraid of being recorded, terrified of the police. So I mostly had to settle for interviews with friends of Julio and the champ. This flower vendor agreed to talk, but not in public. Our interview took place in his windowless bedroom. But the woman who sells flowers in the stall right next to him declined an interview. A few days later, Julio's wife showed up at my hotel. "We have a problem," she said. Julio was arrested that morning on suspicion of assisting a journalist. Turns out that flower lady did talk to someone, her police officer husband. The cops slapped a $350 fine on Julio and kept him in jail until it was paid. I ponied up as much as I could afford to help get him out. Back at Julio's house, Cuban hip-hop blares from a boombox upstairs. Julio introduces me to a tall man who quickly hands me his ID card. National Revolutionary Police, it says. The cop is a former student of Julio's mother, so she begged him to negotiate for Julio's release. That's how Cuba works. The police get their bribe, Julio gets his freedom, the champ and Julio get paid for helping me, Julio gets a police connection for the future. Everybody wins. Even the journalist, who finally got his story.
Grant Fuller is our Latin American correspondent, based in Mexico. Across the world, people have been migrating from one area to another, as long as they've had legs to walk. Some go in search of freedom, some in search of food, some in search of safety or a better way of life. In South Africa, Johannesburg's famous Market Theater has been showcasing a musical called Songs of Migration. It focuses on the joy and the pain of migrants during apartheid, when they left their rural homes for South Africa's mines and farms. Torai Maduna went to the theater and filed this report.
Back in 1886, gold was discovered in Johannesburg. Colonial settlers from Europe who had taken control of the land built gold mines all over the area. By the turn of the 20th century, men from across southern Africa were flocking to the mines in search of better wages. But along with their hope, the migrants also had the pain of leaving their families, a pain that's expressed in song. The majority of the migrants traveled to Johannesburg on trains, which were the cheapest mode of transport.
There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique.
The train was what broke up our society.
That's Yuma Sekela, the legendary South African trumpeter.
Once we were conquered, we had to be transported to industrial places or agricultural places. And the train was the main family breaker in African history, all over Africa. It broke families up.
It was Masekela who came up with the idea for the production of Songs of Migration. He compiled the music for it using mostly old songs that were sung by migrants taking the audience on a historical journey. Masekela is also the lead storyteller in the show. In an interview backstage, the 71-year-old Masekela says the musical was part of his obsession to restore South Africa's heritage through the arts. He says while many migrants went to the cities hoping for a better life, many were also disappointed as they worked long hours for very low wages.
The worst thing about the Industrial Revolution is that it caused people to leave their pastoral and agricultural lives thinking that they were going to get that pot of gold in the city. And they usually sell everything, lock, stock and barrel, and they can't go back to where they come from. And it's still happening today.
Like Masekela, the musical's director, James Ngobo, says it's important for people not to forget about the past.
Songs of Migration will always be about us remembering where we come from. Because I always say we're beginning to be a nation that is walking without a memory.
The musical is set in the 1950s and 60s. The men are elegantly dressed in suits and Panama hats, while the ladies are clad in high heels, simple dresses and berets. There is constant movement of people walking and carrying suitcases, an indication of people who are always on the go. This folk song, Langutula, warns those who leave the countryside for the city to beware of city slickers, pickpockets, muggers, beggars and gangsters. They would take your money if you walked around alone at night. They would impoverish you and bring you bad luck. Most of the songs in this musical were banned during the apartheid regime. Sibongile Khumalo, one of South Africa's most famous female vocalists, explains why.
It was dangerous to sing music like that in those days because, you know, the police would send their people, their informers, who would tell the authorities what the song is talking about.
Khumalo is another lead storyteller in Songs of Migration. Here she sings a tune called Vukani Mawetu.
Literally, Vukani Mawetu means wake up people, wake up my comrades. And, you know, when it starts, it says, Hai usiz lomdomyama, oh, the sadness, the tragedy of the black man in Africa. They all come to our country and they put us down, they oppress us.
Khumalo's parents lived most of their lives under apartheid. She says this music honors people like them and their values.
There was an elegance about the older generation. There is an elegance about them and a grace and a gracefulness, a graciousness in the way that they conducted themselves. And songs like that, that choral sound, that choral stuff, especially from that time, just brings back that memory of these people who are going through the roughest and toughest of times. But they never lost their humanity. They never lost their sense of justice.
Though the setting is South Africa, Songs of Migration is a universal story that transcends time and place. Somebody's Calling Your Name is one of several African-American spirituals that's performed in the musical, honoring the slaves who worked on American cotton plantations. As Hush is performed, the cast walks in a field picking up cotton. Afterwards, the audience rises for a standing ovation.
I thought it was incredible.
Believe me, it was such a beautiful historical timeline through the struggle of a people.
To be honest, it left me feeling really sad because I've spent some time in the last few years working in the communities around South Africa, and I think as much as many of the things are kind of set in the past, it makes me sad that they're still happening today.
And that's part of what the makers of Songs of Migration are hoping people will realize. For the World Vision Report, I'm Taurai Maduna in Johannesburg, South Africa.
And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Today we want to say thank you to World Vision, who's funded this program for the last 7 years. As we continue to bring you international reporting from the ground up, we're looking for other sources of funding to take us forward into the future. If you'd like to make a contribution to this effort, you can do so by visiting our website, worldvisionreport.org, where you'll find more information. Next week, our music special brings you sounds from around the world. We hope you'll tune in for that. Of course, you can always download a podcast of our show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Julie Drizin and Jenny Schmidt are our script editors. Doug Fox, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our engineer, and Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Larry Short is our web producer. Shelley Noe is our general manager. And I'm Rachel Louise Snyder.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.